Welcome to the 21st United We Stand podcast of the season and the first of 2013. Very happy new year to everybody. We've got some great guests lined up this year. The first one is David McDonald. David is a journalist, Manchester correspondent no less, for the Daily Mirror. Welcome, David.
Hi, Andy. How you doing?
Fine. Happy new year. What are you working on at the moment?
Well, you caught me on a day off today, nothing today, but as we speak, Balotelli's had another bust up, this time with Mancini on the training ground, so I've had a few calls on that, so I shall be roping to that. And then tomorrow we've got, obviously every Friday, we've got the United in City press conferences, so we've got Sir Alex in the morning at 9:30 and then Mancini at 10 o'clock, and obviously it's FA Cup weekend, so we'll be previewing that, but I suppose it's a quiet day off today, but as has often been the case in the last 2 years, Balotelli are doing that. But there you go.
I noticed that the pictures were taken at City's training ground, which is less than half a mile from United's training ground. They're almost back onto each other. Why do United manage to keep the paparazzi out, and why does City fail? Is it because there's a right of way which runs right across City's training ground?
Yeah, that's precisely it, Andy. City have got a bridle way, or a public right of way, going right adjacent to their training ground. So anyone can walk along there and observe training. And that's where all the snappers congregate, and they bring their ladders and take pictures of training. And you can get pretty close there. I mean, I've been up there several times and watched training. And a while back, they introduced these large screens in an effort to get a bit more privacy there, because obviously they were sick and tired of all the training ground scraps and whatever else being publicised. So that hasn't worked, and it clearly hasn't worked today, because as most of your listeners or whatever will have seen, I mean, the pictures are pretty clear. I think Balotelli's gone in on Scott Sinclair, and Mancini's tried to pull them apart, and it's all kicked off. So yeah, that's the problem they face, and it's a problem that they'll continue to face until they move into the new training complex, which I don't think is ready until the start of the 2014 season. So they've got a while yet to cope with all the prying eyes of the paparazzi, certainly.
You said you're going to both the United and the City press conferences. How do they compare each week?
Well, as you'd expect, I mean, talking to Alex is very different to talking to Roberto Mancini. It's a bit more formal, I'd say, United. They're both going to split up into sections. The first section will be for the Press Association, Sky, radios, and then there'll be an embargoed section for the newspapers, which will be embargoed till about, I think, 11 o'clock, half 10, 11 that night. So that ensures that we get something different, something fresh, and it's obviously not on Sky Sports News or all over the wires. But I think in terms of tone, Sir Alex's press conferences, and I've been doing United and City now for 11 years, and Sir Alex used to hold them in the little tiny ante room at Carrington, and we used to have a proper dailies huddle, as it were. The radios would go in, the TVs would go in, and then us, the written press, would go in. And it was better back then, because he could let rip, he could F and blind, he could lose his rag, and there was a bit more of an intimacy about it. I mean, not much danger.
That is a horse and cart that has just gone past.
Look at that. Rio, modern day Rio, there's still horse and carts. Is it Rio you're in?
No, I'm in the south of Brazil. I've come here to meet Diego Forlan and interview him for 442 magazine, and also my wife's from it, and Rodrigo Possebon as well. I tracked him down. He's agreed to do an interview for United We Stand. As of a week ago, he didn't have a club, but I've just read that he's signed for a fourth division club today. So I think there's a great story there. If I can meet up with him and have a chat with him about his story, and he agreed to it, and then he's obviously gone quiet. So I don't know whether I'm actually going to get him. I don't think his head's in a great place at the age of 24, and having gone from playing for Manchester United to being without a club in Brazil. Journalistically, there's a good story there, one which our readers would love, and more than happy to let him put his side of the story across. So I'm about 2 hours from Porto Alegre, which is where Diego Forlan plays. He's returned He's returned from Uruguay today after Christmas. And there's horse and carts around.
Indeed. Because the Possibon had that bad injury, didn't he, against Middlesbrough, didn't he?
Yeah, there's a really bad tackle from Pogatetz. People thought it was career-ending, but he did actually get over it. But there's something there, and I'd like to find out what that something is. But I need to sit down with him first and get that. Yeah. So we may get interrupted again by horse and carts, or rag and bowman, as he used to call them in Urmston.
When Fergie used to do them, the written press, just on our own, he could let rip at us, and I think he had a bit more of a relationship with him. Yeah. And then he brought in the cameras, and he felt that was to protect him. Because he felt on occasion he'd be misquoted or misquoted. So, in a sense, it does lack intimacy is probably the wrong word, but you had a better audience with Fergie because he could go off the record back then.
Yeah.
And I think in a way, it served him better then, even though he's the one that took the decision to change the nature of the press conference. I think it served him better because he could qualify things that he said, whereas now, he's got to mind his P's and Q's. I mean, occasionally he doesn't, obviously. But I mean, on the whole, it lacks the intensity and the old fire of old. And that's a shame, but that's a decision he's taken. And we have to live with the consequences of that. Mancini as well, I mean, it's a bit more relaxed because, we don't have the same kind of rapport. But again, we do that interview with him, the embargo section, in front of everybody else. So I think it would serve us better to be doing it in a separate room, where you can develop a bit more of a rapport with the manager and more of an understanding. But that's the problem these days. You know, a lot of clubs as well want to use the second half of the press conference for their own club media. So, that'll be used on MUTV, obviously, that the embargo section of our press conference with Fergie will be used by MUTV and broadcast at sort of 10, 11 at night on a Friday. And the same with City. They'll broadcast it on their website. So we're a victim of that as well. But it does kind of stop you developing any kind of rapport with the manager. I mean, not that any of us really have that kind of a rapport with Fergie because he keeps us at arm's length, as everyone knows.
He didn't used to do that. He used to be quite close to some journalists, and he still is. I mean, the guys are now in the 60s, but he was good friends with some journalists, wasn't he?
I think that changed. I came up here in Dubai. I went to university in Manchester, but I came back here to work to cover United and City and 2001, and I think that coincided with a lot of us of a similar age, sort of during our early 30s at the time, or late 20s at the time, and there was a new breed of reporter, myself, Ian Ladyman, Danny Taylor was obviously up here already, Ollie Kay, Sam Wallace, and it was a new kind of era for us, covering United, and I think Fergie found that a bit difficult to accept at first, because he had his sort of friends in the press covering United, like possibly Peter Fitton and Bob Katz, and there was a rapport there. Whereas we came in and he didn't really connect with us, and he I think he felt we were very very young and naive and right around the ears or right behind the ears. So I think that was a factor in that. I think it was a definite change in the terms of the press back in Manchester. Suddenly you had these guys who were a lot younger. Who Fergie didn't know, didn't trust, didn't have any kind of relationship with. And I think, in the early days then, we did a few stories where he, in the past, may have been protected a bit by the old pack, when he let rip over Veron, I remember, in 2002, just prior to Arsenal winning the league at Old Trafford. He was deafening and blinding and cut short the press conference. And we reported that. And the test of that was, I think, the following day, Five Alive, the whole debate on whether it's right to lose your temper in the workplace and this sort of stuff, that was a decision we took as a group, and I think Ferguson probably didn't thank us for that, but in the past he was able to get away with that kind of thing because people would say, well, that's Alex, that's his way, but we took a different view, possibly paid a price for that, but that's the view we took at the time.
I can remember 10 years ago being in Athens and David Meek, he referred to yourself and the other people as the new breed, the young guns. And for David, it was a big change. He'd obviously retired a few years earlier and he could see all these new journalists coming along. So there wasn't a gradual change, was there? Suddenly there was a load of young lads in the late 20s and a load of older journalists with very few in between.
Yeah, that's exactly the case, Andy. And I think, as I say, I think Fergie found that hard to deal with. You know, he wasn't used to dealing with any of us. And suddenly to have all these young faces and people he didn't think were qualified for the job and didn't have, in his eyes, the requisite experience to be covering a club of size United. He found that difficult. And I think that manifested itself in our relationship with him. You know, we didn't really have the relationship that the likes of Bob Cass and Peter Fitton had with him. And he wasn't really willing to kind of embark on that kind of relationship with us. And I think he felt that we, as I say, didn't really have the experience and to be doing the job. But I mean, it's interesting. A colleague of mine was speaking to Fergie a few months back, and Fergie couldn't believe he was in his early 40s. He still thought he was in his mid 20s or late 20s. And just goes to show for a manager who's one of his greatest strengths is his ability to relate to young people and to constantly reinvent his teams and have this relationship with young people. He still sees us, as journalists, as young whippersnappers and, guys in their 20s who are just out of university or just out of journalism college. He doesn't realise that a lot of us have been doing this job for 10, 15 years on nationals and have built up the requisite experience and everything. So it's interesting. I mean, from our perspective, none of us are ever going to get close to Fergie. I mean, probably the majority of us doing this job now have come too late in his reign to ever get that kind of closeness that possibly our predecessors had. In that respect, there was definitely a sea change about 10 years ago when the new breed, as it were, started covering United.
You said that you studied in Manchester at university. Where are you from originally? Where did you grow up? Who did you support as a kid?
I was born in Dagenham, so Dagenham Dave. But I grew up supporting West Ham, and then grew up in Essex. And then went to Manchester, which was back then Manchester Poly, where it changed to Man Met when I was halfway through my course. But I've always had an affinity with Manchester, having studied here. I've got family up here anyway, and met my wife up here about 10 years ago. So I've always had an affinity with Manchester, originally from the south and originally from Essex.
And you're called Disco. Where does that name come from?
Do you know what? I'd love to be able to tell you where that comes from, but the story is so boring. It would just shatter the illusions. I think it was your pal Graham Hunter, when I was working with him on the Daily Mail, came up with it, Disco Day, about 1997-98, and it just stuck. Now I've done my best to live up to that moniker over the last last sort of decade or so. But that's it. It's quite a boring story. It's a bit of a letdown, isn't it? Really. You expect something a bit more, exciting, a bit meatier than that. Like I was some ex-disco dancing champion, from Essex or something, or ran a mobile disco. But yeah, it's not that exciting, to be honest.
How has your job changed? Because you've been at the Mirror 15 years, and the internet has really come on and become more important. How does that affect your day-to-day job?
Yeah, it's affected it hugely. Two or three years ago, when mirrorfootball.co.uk launched, before that, we would go to press conferences and we would just file stories for the paper. So under no media pressure, and for the wires and everything, all the newspapers were taking, PA copy. Now, we're having to file copy to the websites, almost immediately once the press conference is finished. So we're competing, in a sense, with all the other news agencies and Sky Sports News, BBC, Press Association. So we're kind of wearing two hats and serving two masters. So it is difficult. And of course, our stories come out on the websites at 10:30 every night. So, and I know there's quite a few journalists in our industry who can't get their heads around that. And it is difficult because our stories are out on Twitter. Other people are tweeting about them because our websites put them out even before they appeared in the newspaper. Now, if you have a massive exclusive, obviously, and you're sure that that's not going to come out, before the morning, or anywhere else rather, then of course your paper will hold that back. They won't put it on the internet and alert other people to it, or most papers didn't do that. But it has changed it. I mean, we're 24-hour Sky Sports News. The whole explosion of social media, it has changed our role. And with circulation dwindling on newspapers, there has been definite sort of redefining of our jobs as journalists. And it is difficult to get your head around at times because you are, as I said, serving two masters. And the old idea of just, you know, filing a story for the newspaper has gone out the window. You're working throughout the day, filing stuff for the website, you know, providing content for the website. And, you know, we have to accept as journalists that that change, and that change is irrevocable, really. It's not going to go away.
What have been your best exclusives, which have been worth holding?
Let me think. I guess Rooney staying was the big one. Rooney's U-turn after his contract disputes in October 2010. For, yeah, 2010. Van Nistelrooy being axed for the Carling Cup final, as it was back in 2006. I think he was dropped, and that was the beginning of the end for Rooney. Yeah, the Carling Cup final when they beat Wigan 4-0. That was 2006, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, those kind of stories, you know, huge stories like that, which you're confident that no other journalist or no other paper's got, then you have a discussion with your sports editor, and I think 9 times out of 10, you would agree to hold that back. You know, it's kind of like the old style spoofing of newspapers. You know, if you remember, papers used to spoof their front pages or back pages in order to put their rivals off the scent and then drop their exclusive in the second or third edition. It's a modern-day version of that. You'd hold a story back. From the internet, ensure that, you know, as few people, as few of your competitors as possible get it, and that still goes on. As I say, if you feel that you've got one for yourself, then, you know, you do everything you can to keep it off the internet until you actually have to put it out there.
You talk about spoofing, and you talked about Wayne Rooney saying he was going to stay in late 2010. Both of those are reasons why I joined Twitter in the first place. I got a call off Manchester United asking me to discuss comments I'd made on Twitter regarding Rooney staying. I said, I'm not on Twitter. They said, well, yes, you are. I'm not on Twitter at all. I said, well, yeah, you are. And someone was using my name and pretending to be me. And I had a look on Twitter for the first time. And this guy, whoever he was, had 600 followers and was making me out to look a bit of a knob, saying things like, right, I'm just popping out for a coffee with Lionel Messi now. I'll be back in a bit. So whoever was pretending to be me on Twitter said, listen, Reds, Rooney's going nowhere at all. I've just had a word with Fergie. And whoever it was, yeah, guessed absolutely right.
Well, there you go. That's so they painted him in a good light then.
Yeah, so he outscooped you, the false me, whoever he was.
It's only 2 years to break that news to me, but thanks. I think it's interesting with Twitter as well, because we're talking about social media. I mean, you know, we get, because we're out there, journalists, you know, it's an open forum. I mean, you get a lot of criticism. I mean, it does beg a belief sometimes. You get accused of being pro-United, being anti-United, being pro-City and anti-City. And there's no consistent theme. I think obviously every fan is protective of their club. And if you write a negative story about their club, then obviously that's going to get their back up. And, you know, you have to, if you're on Twitter, you know, as everyone knows, you've got to take the abuse. You know, it's an open forum. But I do find it interesting because, you know, no fan ever, you know, writes, you know, comes onto us on Twitter and says, you know, well done for writing that about United. You know, I mean, no club has got more positive press than Manchester United, you know, given their achievements. You know, we write probably 80% of our coverage of United is positive because of their winning ratio and because of the trophies they win. And similarly with City. But you do get people out there who think that you've got an agenda against, you know, one club or the other. And the reality is that if there's a decent news story out there, you know, whether that's detrimental to City or United, we're going to write it. And I think, you know, people accuse me of being a United fan or a City fan or up Fergie's arse and this sort of stuff. And it's interesting from our perspective that there are such a disparate, you know, views out there. As I say, people think you know, one day you're pro United, and someone else will think you're pro City. So you can't have both ways. But it just opens your eyes to the sort of, you know, different views that are out there, and how your work and how your you know, journalism is perceived.
There's also a lot of angry, anonymous, intense people who are on Twitter, who are on the internet, and the arguments which you have, it's very one-sided in some ways, because these people might be having a pop when they're anonymous, but I see a lot of people now, not just journalists, they're not even engaging anymore, they're just withdrawing from it, because they'd be more than happy to communicate and have a reasoned argument with people, a reasoned discussion with people, but they've got people sniping at them basically from an anonymous position, and they're thinking, who am I talking to here in a public arena as well?
Well, Yeah, absolutely. And I can see that. I mean, I think I've had a couple of colleagues who've done that, gone off Twitter. I think one or two of them have subsequently come back. But listen, if people are rude and abusive and offensive, then I block them. You know, I'm all up for reasoned debate and banter, and that's what Twitter's about, isn't it? And it should be a fun forum. It's, you know, it's a weapon or, you know, a tool by which you can share information and have a bit of fun as well. And I think we're all up for that. And, you know, we can handle having the piss taken out of us. You know, we're in the firing line. We get it wrong sometimes. We get stories wrong. You know, we go over the top sometimes. Equally, we get stuff right sometimes. So there has to be a balance there. But I think, as you say, Andy, when people start abusing you, and, you know, pretty, you know, pathetic abuse and they're rude to you, then, you know, I don't see why I should take that. And so I block them. You know, I think you have one chance, and, you know, if you want to have an interaction or a reasoned debate, then I'm all up for that. But, you know, if you're going to be rude, then, you know, forget it.
We've talked about your greatest scoops. What about stories you've got wrong? Were there any where you look back and think, oof, I cringe at that one?
I think, where do I start? There have been so many. I mean, the funny thing about cancer stories as well, and a lot of my colleagues will agree with me on this one, is that, you know, fans of Toronto say, oh, you said that, you know, United were buying so-and-so, and, you know, it's complete rubbish, you know. The fact is, United probably look at, you know, 20, 30, 40, I don't know how many players, and you know, scout them. So they're not going to buy all of them, of course. So, you know, you might get a steer from an agent, or you might get a steer from somewhere else, and that interest might be genuine, it might be looking at that player, but it doesn't obviously mean that, you know, that will come full circle and United will end up buying that player, or City will end up buying that player. So you do get a lot of flack over transfer stories. But yeah, we get stuff wrong, you know, I wouldn't say all the time, but I mean, you know, it's the nature of the beast. If you're writing for a paper, as I am, 6 days a week, then, you know, you're going to be a bit hit and miss, and you're going to get stories wrong. Off the top of my head, I can't think of one right now, but if you give me a bit of time, I'll probably have my brain to think of one before the end of this conversation.
You can come back to us on that one.
I threw the Fifth Amendment on that one.
We spoke about tumbling circulations and declining newspaper circulations. I work as a journalist full-time myself, and I speak to a lot of other journalists, and there's a lot of despondency from people who are finding it a very hard way to make a living. Not all, you know, some people are still doing really well, and they blame the internet, they blame newspapers giving away their content for free. Somebody told me about The Guardian last week that a lot of their journalists are leaving. They're replacing experienced journalists with young people on half the wage of the people that they're replacing. And yet The Guardian must say that their website has never been more popular, and yet that's a newspaper which loses £40 million a year. It all seems bizarre. The business models seem flawed. What's your view on it all?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to pretend to be a businessman and have that acumen. I mean, all I can say is, from, you know, a journalistic standpoint, it is depressing when you see, you know, people losing, you know, experienced journalists losing their jobs because of cutbacks. And that's just not in newspapers or media in general. Of course, that's across the board with the worldwide recession. But in terms of the media, and in terms of newspapers, yeah, we are having to, as I say, you know, wear two hats and serve two masters with the internet and with our newspapers. I think it's a very difficult industry now. If I was coming into the industry now, you know, as a graduate or as a trainee reporter, you know, I mean, my advice wouldn't be don't come into the business, because it's a fantastic profession. I mean, I'd be very fortunate. It is a privilege. I mean, don't get me wrong, we work hard. But, you know, we don't lose sight of the fact that we get paid to watch football, and that's a privilege that we all respect. But the, you know, the jobs are shrinking. You know, the number of jobs in the industry is shrinking, and it's a worrying trend. And I don't see that picking up, really. As I say, newspapers are losing circulation. They're failing to attract younger readers, and that's what everyone's chasing. But of course, you know, young people now aren't buying newspapers in the way that perhaps you or I did, you know, 20 years ago, or our generation did. They're getting internet content on tablets and iPads and whatever else, and downloads. So it's a challenge to the industry, and I'm not going to sit here and say, I'll give the answers, because I haven't, but it's going that way, and I don't see how, you know, it's going to be reversed. I mean, newspapers are trying to, like I say, attract more readers and diversify with the internet content. But it is a worrying trend when you, as you say, Andy, you give an example of The Guardian, which is losing, you know, an extraordinary amount of money.
More about the football teams that you watch. What have you made of United over the festive period? I think only Chelsea under Mourinho have ever won all four games in 10 days. United did very well, got 10 points out of 12, just dropping points at Swansea. Playing well, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they're playing extremely well. And I think, you know, if you'd offered United and United fans a 7-point lead, you know, they wouldn't have believed it at this stage of the season. I mean, you have to say City have stumbled a little bit. You know, they've had a bit of a dip. But, you know, United, you have to say the difference has been Dan Percy. Mancini said that. We spoke to him last week. I'm losing track of days now over Christmas. But we spoke to him a few days back, and he said that City were, he said, very close, and he sort of gestured with his thumb and forefinger together. He said that City were very, very close, this close to signing Van Persie, and he's been a difference in the title race this season. I'm not so sure about that. I know that City felt, you know, they possibly had an agreement with Arsenal in place. But if you listen to Van Persie, you know, when he was unveiled as a United player, he said that United was the, you know, the only club for him. That was the only club he would have left Arsenal for. And I feel that. I think that Van Persie, you know, the noises coming out of Arsenal and from Van Persie's camp were that he was just hell-bent on joining United because of the history and tradition of the club, and didn't really consider City. Even though he could have earned a lot more money at City, that really wasn't a consideration for him. He wanted to go to United. And I have to say, with really being injured at the start of the season, with, you know, the Dash die and having injured again, you know, Van Persie with 19 goals has really been the difference between the two sides. And he's given United a different dimension. You know, they can play with two strikers, he can drop off, he can roam out wide. It just gives them an extra dimension. And I think that's been the difference this season. You have to be honest about that.
You think United will win the league back from City?
I think so. I mean, I think they will. I mean, they've got the advantage now. I think Wales will be interesting because, of course, City aren't in Europe now. And, you know, FA Cup, you know, notwithstanding, they're only going to have one game a week, which could become a bit of a deciding factor after Christmas now. So in the next few months, that could be a factor. But, you know, United are used to playing Wednesday, Saturday. They've been down this road several times before. They're used to fighting on, you know, several fronts. So I don't think that will be a problem. The problem will be is if United get injuries and then they're having to, they possibly could be compromised in terms of the Champions League one. But, of course, you know, they've got the Real Madrid game to come, so that's going to be a huge one if they get past that. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, how Fergie juggles his squad. But he's so experienced at doing that. I think that would be a problem. But City will be able to keep their players a lot fresher simply because they've only got the one game a week, you know, and a possible FA Cup tie, you know, thrown in as well.
United have got a huge squad. There's lots of different permutations and possibilities, and this Alex Ferguson, you know, traditionally United played 4-4-2. That's all changed now. It varies. The formation varies according to the opponents. And you mentioned the Real Madrid game. I've no idea what team United are going to play there, but it's a cracking tie to look forward to.
It is a huge tie. I mean, not least, you know, the return of Ronaldo to Old Trafford and Mourinho, of course, and all the speculation about whether he's going to be the one that succeeds Fergie. I think the advantage for United is obviously finishing top of the group. They've got the second leg at home, and that's always traditionally been a big advantage to teams. You know, if you can get a result away, if you imagine you get some kind of result, you know, even if they're totally 2-1 or even score over there, you know, just get something to bring back to Old Trafford. I think United could do it. I don't see, I mean, I know this is a great Real Madrid team, but, you know, we're aware that there are, if we're led to believe it's true, there are divisions in the camp, you know, between them. You know, the Spaniards and the Portuguese, and there's a bit of disharmony there. Ronaldo's not happy there. They've had a poor start to La Liga, as you know, Andy. I mean, you see more of them than I do. So there are frailties there with Real Madrid. I mean, City were leading 2-1, weren't they, until they imploded in the burnabout. So I think United, you know, people are talking, oh, it's the toughest draw. Well, I'm not so sure about that. I think, you know, it's a tough game. Don't get me wrong. You know, I think they would prefer to have avoided Real Madrid or Barcelona until later on. But the old cliche says that you've got to beat the best teams to win it. And I wouldn't discount United win, certainly over the two legs. I think they've got the personnel, they've got the manager, and they've got that crucial second leg at home. So I think it'll be a fascinating time. A
couple of points there. Not the last time, United played in Bernabeu in 2000, when United were the European champions. They got the draw away from home. and everybody was feeling confident coming back to Old Trafford. And Madrid won. And Madrid completely outclassed United. So I take the point about the away draw, but with a team with like Madrid, you've got so many good world-class attackers. You can never truly rest until the tie's over. And then you mentioned Madrid themselves. You know, I spend divide my time between Manchester and Barcelona. I go to Madrid probably four or five times a year. I watch them an awful lot and watch them closely, stay abreast of what's happening there. And the issues you mentioned are spot on, and there are many more issues. You know, Casillas, the captain of the club, the captain of Spain, he was dropped for so-called technical reasons before Christmas, and then Jose Mourinho put a very inexperienced keeper in, and Madrid lost 3-2 at Malaga. The fans are firmly behind Casillas. They've really swung against Mourinho. And when public opinion goes against the Real Madrid manager, something tends to be done about it. You don't get the longevity that you would get at an English club. A lot of Spaniards can't understand why Ferguson's been at United for so long, why Wenger's been at Arsenal for so long. And Mourinho is persona non grata with a lot of Real Madrid fans at the moment. And the president would save his own back before he saves his manager. His job. There's conflicts in the dressing room. You alluded to the point with the Portuguese. There are Portuguese players in Madrid's dressing room who will say in private that they are being discriminated against because of their nationality. They'll say everything's fine when they're winning, but the minute they stop winning, the people come out and they blame the foreigners. And that's not the first time that's happened. That happened in the 90s, and you get lots of players who'll go on the record and we'll say that. So Madrid is not a happy camp at all. Right. However, when I look at the team, and I was in the Bernabeu when they played City, went to cover it. They were so dominant. They did to City what I haven't seen any team do to City this season. Completely dominate them. You knew they were going to score. They left it very, very late. City went ahead twice. But you've got players like Benzema, Higuain, Ronaldo. They're top, top class players. They're just a very dangerous team to beat. That said, I'm as confident as I was in 2000 when I went there to watch United.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, I saw this Real Madrid side, obviously. I mean, I didn't go out to the Bernabeu for the City game, but I mean, I saw them when they came to the Etihad. And they totally outclassed City again and sort of won that game as well. So, listen, I mean, I'm not saying that they won't present a major threat and the odds are stacked against United, but I just feel with Van Persie and you know you'll have Rooney back and Kagawa will probably be fit then. Ferguson will have a lot more options at his disposal, and I think it'll be a tighter tie than a lot of people are predicting. I mean, of course, it all depends on how United fare at the Bernabeu. I mean, if they get beaten heavily there, then you know it's going to be an uphill struggle for them. But as I say, if they can come back with something from there, game on, as it were.
You mentioned Kagawa. One of the new additions in the Old Trafford press box so far this season has been a number of Japanese journalists. I first saw it pre-season when there were more Japanese journalists than there were British journalists in Oslo pre-season. They're there, of course, to cover Shinji Kagawa. What have you made of him and how good do you think he can be? Because he's had his time disrupted a little bit by injury so far. And if you speak to United fans about him, they like what they've seen, but they're not entirely convinced as to where he's going to fit in with the side.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, as you say, Andy, he's had injuries. I mean, he made a great start. And I mean, I only saw him sort of sporadically when he was playing for Dortmund. But, I mean, he obviously, you know, Fergie and Mike Phelan went over there and watched him in the German Cup final where they beat Bayern Munich, I think, 4-2. I think that was on the eve of the last day of last season. And, yeah, he's a very versatile player. He can, you know, I think his preferred position is just off the main striker, just in the hole there. But he can play wide. The problem is we've not probably had a real chance to see what he can do because of the injury, of course. But I think he's, again, another player like Van Persie who gives United something different. You know, he's a very neat and tidy player. He gets into those pockets, you know, between the midfield and defence and can cause problems for opponents then. But the injury, I think he was out for a lot longer than was expected. I think it was two and a half months in the end when it was initially thought to be only about four or five weeks. So he had a setback there. But there's no doubt he was the Bundesliga player of the year, I think, last season. I think he may have been before that as well, but certainly last season. So there's no doubt in his talent, his ability to change things. But we've yet to see the best of him. But as you say as well, the key is, you know, where does he fit in? Because United have got so many options now. With Rooney, I know Rooney's injured now, but and Rooney comes back. And, you know, Van Persie's, you know, a shoo-in, obviously. You know, you're not going to get him out of the team if he's fit and on form. And then you've got Kagawa as well. And then you've obviously got Valencia and Young. You know, you've got a lot of permutations there. And so I think Fergie's got a bit of a dilemma when all his players are fit as to what his best formation is. I mean, he's, as you say, we're alluding to, you know, 4-4-2 is the way United have traditionally played with the two wingers. But there's been a shift that has been in football, you know, in recent years for this 4-2-3-1 formation. And that's the formation you can see United, you know, probably using in Europe, certainly, as they have done in recent seasons. So it's been interesting to see how he deploys the personnel that he's got in that framework.
You're a West Ham fan. Do you ever get to see him play now? Do you ever get to go to a game as a fan, or are you too busy in the north covering United and City?
I'm too busy in the north because if United are away, obviously City are at home, so I'm always up here. But so the only time I get to see them is when they're up here in Manchester, you know, against City or United, and occasionally, obviously, when they're playing Bolton or Blackburn or Wigan, or occasional trips to Merseyside. So I don't get a chance to see them so much now. So yeah, it's a shame that, but you know, I get to see them a lot.
And they're playing Manchester United in the FA Cup this week.
Yes. Yeah, I don't have that much hope for that one. Although, I mean, West Ham's done well under Allardyce. You know, I think he got a lot of stick from, you know, West Ham fans for not playing the West Ham way. And you know, he was quite forthright, Sam, in coming out saying, "Well, what is the West Ham way?" You might hear a lot about this West Ham way, but it's a way of getting effective results. And I think he's managed to forge an effective side there. And, you know, it's not pretty. I mean, you know, at times it's not been pretty, but you know, it's effective. And you know, he's the same with Bolton. You know, he gets results playing. But, you know, and I don't. You want to play pretty football, you want to play your team to play attractive football, but the bottom line is results, isn't it? And you know, I think West Ham have done enough this season to stay up. Well, not, you know, not counting chickens yet, but they've done enough certainly, and they've had a great start to the season, so you know, long may that continue.
We spoke about the two Manchester clubs. You cover other clubs on your beat. Which managers you going well with, which are nice to deal with, and who's been particularly difficult to deal with over the years?
Well, Fergie is always difficult. I mean, he's a unique case, isn't he? And I tend to concentrate on United and City, really. That the Manchester beat is my sort of beat, my patch. Probably the most unfailingly polite manager I've ever had the pleasure of dealing with was Ericsson. I mean, Sven was, you know, charm personified. You know, he was always had time to speak to us. You know, he was always, even away from the kind of formality of press conferences and that kind of thing, and post-match interviews. He was always bright, he'd always say hello to you, he'd always chat with you. Maybe I had a bet with him, I can't remember what it was about now, but I had a bet with him at a football writer's dinner, and he paid up. I think I won the bet, it was about 20 quid. I think it was about someone scoring X amount of goals that season, and he paid up. So he was great. I mean, I know he got a lot of flack because he was England boss, but I mean, you know, to us, in terms of our day-to-day dealings with him, particularly when he was at City for that season, he was excellent to deal with. Mancini, can be difficult. He doesn't like to do that many press conferences. Mancini, he's put David Hart in quite a few times in recent weeks, and I think he's not a fan of press conferences. So he tends to kind of, you know, let Pat take over those duties. But Fergie's difficult to deal with. I mean, not one of the great regrets, you know, we have, I think, in terms of us lot covering United, is that we don't travel with the team anymore for European ties. So whereas, yeah, about two seasons ago, we would travel on the team flight, on the charter flight. We'd sit at the back of the plane, the officials or the corporate guests would be in the middle and in the team, and Fergie would be at the front with all the coaching staff. We were told 2 years ago that, you know, the club had more commercial commercial demand for seats and sponsors and whatnot, so there wouldn't be any space for the media. And that was a great shame because Fergie, you know, up to a point, used to do a huddle at the airport. And that served him because, obviously, it didn't, you know, we wouldn't ask questions at the general UEFA press conference because we got our stuff already from him. And it helped him because he wasn't, you know, waylaid there. And that's a shame. So now we've kind of lost that sort of benefit with Fergie because we don't travel with the team anymore. I'm not so sure it's sponsorship, but, you know, that's an argument for another day. But in terms of dealing with Fergie, yeah, as I said at the outset of this, you know, none of us are close to Fergie. None of us have the relationship that others do. And he is difficult to deal with. I mean, he's a unique character, as everybody knows. And, you know, he knows how to play us at times. He knows you know, what buttons to push. If you just look back a couple of weeks or 10 days or so to the Alan Pardew, you know, business, you know, that was rehearsed. You know, I mean, as I say, you know, covering Fergie for, covering United rather, for 10, 11 years, you get a feeling for when he wants to get a message out there, when he wants something, you know, wants to use us, the media, to get a message across. And he wanted to get that about, you know, a wee club in the northeast, about Newcastle, on the attack on Pardew. So it's interesting, you know, dealing with him. You can tell when there's something that he wants to sort of, you know, just drop in there. And he's done it in the past with Benitez. He's done it in the past on numerous occasions. And so, you know, he'll frame this. I mean, I'm not saying he likes us at all. He doesn't know us as individuals. And he sure hasn't got the time of day for us. But he will use us when it suits him. So in that respect, it's an interesting relationship, definitely. It's hard to get on with, in the sense of you'll never see the truth very well, you'll never get close to it. So in an answer to your question about who we're good to deal with, I mean, Fergie's great to deal with, because you never know what it's going to come out with. And, you know, we all say, you know, we'll definitely listen when he's gone, because he provides us such great coffee. Whether he's ranting and raving, or whether he's, you know, X, Y, and Z, he's always great coffee, Fergie. You know, because of his sheer force of personality, as much as anything else. So we'll definitely miss him when he's gone.
How long do you think he'll stay on for?
I knew the answer. I kind of let myself into that one, didn't I, with that last comment. I mean, there have been whispers over the last few weeks from various sources and people, and, you know, that, oh, it could be his last season, and that, you know, if he gets the title back from City, and he has a good run in the European Cup. I mean, I don't think there's a good run in the European Cup with Massa. I think he wants to win it again, definitely. I mean, how feasible that is, I'm not so sure, because the quality, as we all know, in Europe is so high now. It's a difficult one. It's a million-dollar question, isn't it, Andy? I mean, everyone, if you write it, people can say, oh, that's rubbish, you know, Fergie. And the point is, Fergie won't come out and say when he's going to go, because he made that mistake once before in 2001-2, and then reversed the decision in January 2002. So he's not going to make that same mistake twice. He's not going to come out and publicly say, yes, I'm going. I know there were quotes a couple of days ago from an interview he did with Abu Dhabi Sports, where he said that I'm here for a while yet. But you wouldn't expect Fergie or David Peel or the Glazers to give any hint whatsoever as to when he's going to step down. I mean, he's 71 now. He's got the vigour and the verve of a man 10 years younger. I mean, you know, he's not a typical 71-year-old. He's more like a 60, 61-year-old in terms of his outlook and his energy levels and his appetite for the job and his passion. And we saw that against Newcastle on Boxing Day, when he had the infamous rant with Mike Dean and the fourth official and the assistant referee. So his passion has not waned. I mean, his fire has not waned. I just think that, you know, again, it's just personal, but I think if you won the title back from City, and I think Mourinho was available this summer, that seems to be the case. It's all heading to one conclusion. You know, that leads you on to who's going to be a successor. And again, it's a difficult one, because, you know, candidates that may be on the horizon now, if Fergie decides to go on for another couple of years, you know, might not be in jobs or might not be suitable in a couple of years. So, but I think, you know, largely speaking, you're probably down to two or three candidates in Mourinho, Guardiola, and I think David Moyes, because I think if United want an empire, you know, like Fergie or a dynasty, then I think someone like Moyes is a better manager for that than Mourinho, who you know, given his past form, is probably going to come in like a whirlwind for two or three years and maybe win trophies, but probably not last much longer than that. And of course, Guardiola as well, you know, he built that team, but he inherited a lot of those players, and he presided over that great Barcelona team. I'm just not so sure, you know, it'd be interesting to see if he did get a job, how he'd fare in the Premier League. You know, it's a different culture. So there are so many permutations, and it's, you know, anyone who stands up now and says, oh, yeah, Fergie is definitely going to go at the end of this season, you know, I don't think they know for sure, certainly, because none of us do. And I think, I don't think Fergie does. I think he's waiting to see how he feels and how the season pans out. And, you know, why should he really think about quitting? If United are still winning trophies, he's enjoying the job, he's healthy, you know, the players are still responding to him, he's having an impact in that dressing room, as he has done for, you know, 2.5 decades now. Why would he think about quitting? You know, the moment to quit is when you lose that passion, and United aren't the force they were. But, you know, given the way they performed this season, that's not the case at all.
I don't think the decision's been made. I hear things like you do from people very close to him and their observations, and there's definitely more chatter than there was a year ago. and the fact that Mourinho is probably going to lose his job and that Guardiola is available adds to that. But, you know, people close to him, they tell you things and they make observations as well, and they're entitled to make them, but it's not their decision either. You mentioned David Moyes. I interviewed Luis Sahar in the summer, and he said he's the man to manage Manchester United. He was adamant about that. And it surprised me how forcefully he put that point of view across. And with Moyes, he's done a great job at Everton and been impressed by Everton this year, not for the first time. They were far better than Manchester United on the opening day of the season. And you think, what could he do if he had the resources which he'd get at Manchester United? But it's all speculation. Yeah. You mentioned Fergie and not knowing any of you personally, but I'm sure I saw a little tweet of yours at the start of the year where you went to a football writer's do and he saw you on the stairs in a London hotel and said, "Good evening, David, how are you?"
Yes, that's right. Yeah, he did, yeah. I think they just won at Arsenal, so he was obviously in a good mood. Although when my wife went up to ask for an autograph, he told her to go away. So I don't think that warmth extends to my family. But again,
this is the whole enigma that's wrapped up in Fergie that he is. You know, the moment you think you're in with him is the moment he'll cut you dead. It'll be the moment that he'll blank you, that he'll ignore you. So I don't think any of us are foolish enough or naive enough or vain enough to think that we're ever going to be part of Fergie. Yeah? And nor we want to be. You know, there's a demarcation line there. You know, we know our job is to report on the club, and it's an occupational hazard that you're going to write stuff that's going to piss him off, and it's going to piss the players off. And, you know, thankfully we don't, to a certain extent, get involved in the stuff at the front of the paper, because, again, there has to be a separation there. You know, we don't get involved in the players' private lives. Occasionally, you know, as in the case of Rooney or other players, those kind of issues will spill over. But I think, you know, you'd like to think that, you know, people like Fergie and players and other managers recognise that we're in this job because we love football. You know, we're football fans at the end of the day. And, you know, we're journalists. Of course, we're trained journalists. You know, we've all started our careers on local papers. And, you know, if there's a news story that we have, then we have to do it. It's our duty to do that. And you'd like to think that they recognise that. But as I say, you know, you can have occasions where you can have conflicts. But, you know, that doesn't mean to say that there can't be, you know, some sort of rapport there. But that's certainly gone out of football. I mean, I remember, just, you know, as an aside, you know, hanging around the car park at West Ham, and, you know, when I was working in London and Spurs, and you could get players then, you could speak to players, you could just, you know, approach them on spec and have a chat. And the culture's changed now with agents and the money in football and the whole profile that football's got. Even in 15 years' time, you know, the last 15 years, it's all changed. And, you know, agents are in the way, you know, interviews now are much harder to come by. If you do an interview with a player, it tends to be product-based. So, you know, it's on the back of promoting a video game or a boot or a ball or some sort of whatever, you know. I mean, it's just, it's gone to that extreme now. And so developing relationships with players is quite difficult. I mean, I got on very, very well with Rio when he was at West Ham. When he was coming through as a 17, 18-year-old or 16-year-old, probably back then. And then, of course, he went to Leeds and I lost contact with him. And he came to United. And although I get on with him, and the players do sort of have a nodding acquaintance with us, it is difficult to maintain that kind of relationship because of the scale of football now, because of agents and because of the money involved. And, yeah, that's a shame, you know, because back then it was, you know, you could have a relationship with players and, you know, players could set himself off the record, and you know, a lot of that to a large extent. I mean, don't get me wrong, that we all have our contacts on the playing side, and you know, contacts you know elsewhere with agents and whatnot. But in terms of relationships, it has become more difficult, I think.
Thanks for your time, David.
Pleasure. Thanks, Andrew.
So that's it for this episode of United We Stand podcast. Apologies that the sound dipped in and out a little bit there. It's what happens when you Skype someone on the other side of the world. We're working on the next issue of United We Stand, which is out against Liverpool. Until next week, goodbye.